I killed Dietrichson. Me, Walter Neff, insurance agent, 35 years old, unmarried, no visible scars. Until a while ago, that is. Yeah, I killed him. I killed him for money and for a woman. It all began last May. I was thinking about that dame upstairs and the way she had looked at me. And I wanted to see her again, close, without that silly staircase between us. How could I have known that murder can sometimes smell like honeysuckle?
I can't stand it anymore. What if they do hang me?
They're not going to hang you, baby.
It's better than going on this way.
They're not going to hang you. Because you're going to do it, and I'm going to help you.
Yes, from the moment they met, it was murder. Always behind them, with his devilish hunches and his brilliant brain, was Keyes.
The murder's never perfect. Always comes apart sooner or later. And where two people are concerned, it's usually sooner.
Could they get away from him and his relentless pursuit? And could they get away with murder?
You don't know Keyes. Once he gets his teeth into something, he never lets go. He'll investigate you. He'll have you shadowed. He'll watch you every minute from now on. You afraid, baby?
Yes, I'm afraid. But not of Keyes. I'm afraid of us.
I'd like to move in on her right now, tonight. If it wasn't for Norton and his striped pants ideas about company policy, I'd have the cops after her so quick it'd make her head spin. Now, we know the Dietrichson dame is in it, and somebody else.
Only haven't got a single thing to go on, Keyes.
He'll show. He's got to show. Sometime, somewhere, they've got to meet.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining us this episode to talk about the classic Double Indemnity, starring Fred McMurray, Barbara Stanwyck, and Edward G. Robinson, is Tom Paneris. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I have to say right at the top of the show, I'm really sorry it's taken this long to have you on the Film and Water Podcast. You and I have been in each other's podcasting orbit for like 4 or 5 years now. And I've actually been on one of your shows to talk about a movie, which Pop Cultural Affidavit, was that the show I was on?
It's Pop Cultural Affidavit. We talked about All the President's Men back in November of 16, I think it was.
Well, how'd that turn out?
It was one of the last things that came out in the before time.
People seem to laugh.
Because it came out on election day. I released it on election day.
Oh, God.
And we had recorded it like a month before, so it was like, you know, on the eve of destruction.
Lord. It reminds me of that. It was the episode that of Film and Water that came out the day after was literally the day after was seven days in May with me and Ryan Daly, and it was like, yeah, boy, what does everyone want to hear about on Wednesday? Politics. You know? Like, oh, good thinking, Rob. Anyway, I'm very sorry it's taken this long to have you on the show. We've been talking about this for years, and you have offered me a bunch of movies to talk about, and I was like, oh yeah, let's do it. And I just kept putting it off for reasons, but we're finally here. You're here. We're here to talk about Double Indemnity, directed by Billy Wilder, one of the greatest movies ever made, one of the greatest examples of film noir. I think if, like, any, you know, cursory examination of the film noir genre, this movie is going to be listed. It's just one of the great all-time movies, and so we're going to have a lot of fun talking about it. Now, so, like, what's your history with this movie, Tom? Like, why did you want to talk about this one?
I actually first encountered this movie in film class in college. I was one of those high school students who actually tried. So I took a bunch of AP courses in high school, and I was never under the mistaken impression that I was going to be able to graduate college early, like some students tend to be when they gain a lot of college credit in high school. Especially since, like, my major had a seminar course that you had to take spring of your senior year. So I was there for 4 years, no matter, you know, how many courses I took. But it freed me up to take electives toward the end of my college experience. And Loyola, I went to Loyola, Maryland in Baltimore, and they had a intro to film class. And it really was like film 101. And we got like a textbook of all about learning the basic terms of filmmaking, like, you know, what's a double shot, what's a wide shot, like how mise en scene, which I'm probably pronouncing like mise en scene.
Oh, right. Mise en scene.
Mise en scene, because mise en place is in cooking. and like all the basic, seriously, like all the basic vocabulary, all basic terminology. And it was one of those classes that was just, I could take it as an elective, and I was like, yeah, why not? And it was, I remember it was like a Wednesday night class. So it ran from like 6:30 to 9:30 on Wednesday nights. And we just sat and talked about movies, and our homework was always to watch the movies that we were going to discuss. And then my film professor, who sometimes would show up like 20 minutes late, and I swear he was like baked out of his mind. But every once in a while, he had a good story about John Waters, because Loyola's located near the neighborhood where John Waters lives.
I would say all stories about John Waters are good stories.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, like, this is my one – I've never encountered John Waters in the wild, but
– it's a good turn of phrase for it.
Yeah. I know the you've seen Serial Mom.
I have.
Okay. The video store where Matthew Lillard – like, the video store in that movie was right down the block from my – dorm room freshman and sophomore year, and it's called Video American. I don't know if it's still open or not. This was the mid-90s, and I kind of regret never getting an account there, because I heard they had a really, really good selection, but they wanted like a cancel check for so much money to get a membership, and I was a broke college student, so I also had a Blockbuster card, so we ended up going to the Blockbuster down the street.
Oh, anyway, that makes me sad.
So long story short, part of the homework for this was to watch all these movies, and he lined up stuff from the earlier 30s or 40s into the 90s. And I remember we started with Citizen Kane, and there was Nashville, Wall Street, Glengarry Glen Ross, The Graduate, 2001. There might have been one or two. What Jim Jarmusch film?
Strangers in Paradise?
Paradise.
Stranger Than Paradise.
Strangers in Paradise is the Terry Moore series, yes, that I absolutely love. he's a very nice guy, by the way. I've met him. And then a Hal Hartley film called, and I think it was called Trust.
He's got one called The Unbelievable Truth, and then he has one called Trust. Yeah, I think you're right.
I can't remember which one we watched. I want to say we watched Trust. And I want to say there might have been one or two more movies, but those are the movies I specifically remember going through, and so this was one of them. This was like the second or third one, and I had heard of the term film noir before, but I was very, very inexperienced with it. And I think my impression of what film noir was probably through, like, and this is probably a mismatch back in my mind, in like my early 20s, I thought of like Cagney movies and stuff, but I don't think those, I think it was gangster movies, but I thought of those old movies. So I sat down to watch this in like where they were showing it in the library, and we sat down to watch this with me and a couple of people from the class, and I was blown away just at how good this movie was. And this was 1998-99. And it actually opened me up to, there's some Billy Wilder films I've seen and some I haven't, but taking that class, even though I never went into screenwriting or filmmaking or anything, opened me up even further to better movies that existed before my time or pre-Jaws. And, cause you know, I was born in 77. So I was raised on Star Wars.
Sure, sure.
I lived at the video store when I was a teenager because I had nothing better. I had no life. So basically my Friday nights were at the video store. But I was renting John Hughes movies, and I was renting John Cusack movies, and then I was renting like really shitty 80s horror movies. So, you know, like – and some of the good ones. Like, you know, that's where I cut my teeth on like Nightmare on the Street and Friday the 13th and stuff like that, where I wasn't seeing them in the theater because I was too young. But I was like – so I was basically within the 10 or 15 years of my existence was where I was kind of very comfortably housed. But then this was like – these are movies that existed before then that I just essentially never heard of. And maybe I came across them on TV, you know, because I don't know if some of the syndicated channels would show these things or not. But – but yeah, so I think like, you know, an old movie to me was like the copy of Ben-Hur that we had, or The Wizard of Oz. I had an appreciation for old movies, but this made me want to watch older movies. And I, every time I come back to this, and I've seen this movie like four or five times by now over the last 20 years, it never gets old. And it never seems dated, even though this movie's like –
steeped in the culture of 1942. It's set in 38, but it's made in 44. But it's steeped in that culture. But yeah, you're right. It does feel sort of timeless in its own weird way.
This movie's older than my father, and it's like, but it still does not feel. Yeah, it doesn't feel as dated as I don't know, something like you like 50s television, for instance, feels so dated. And it's like, you know, or even like 80. There's certain 80s movies which are like, you know, this is so of its time that you have to kind of suspend disbelief to be like, okay, like this actually is happening. But this, I don't know. I think it's the screenwriting, and I think it's some of the style it's shot. It's like it firmly places itself within its genre. And that's why I think it works so well.
Well, I mean, it concerns itself with two really awful people, and there will be awful people no matter what year we're living in. So I mean, that, you know, there could be people like this nowadays. You know, these idiots who think they've pulled off the perfect crime, and it all goes wrong so quickly. And I mean, first of all, I mean, this is the third film directed by Billy Wilder, and Billy Wilder is, you know, one of the greatest guys ever to do it. He directed a film in France called Mauvaise Grand A. I'm sure I just butchered that, but I'm not sure how you pronounce it. That's his first film. Then he came to Hollywood. He directed The Major and The Minor, which I have not seen. Then he did Five Graves to Cairo from 1943, which, pretty good movie. I am sure that Mr. Spielberg and Mr. Lucas saw this movie before they sat down to write Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then he did Double Indemnity. And this was really the first one that put him on the map, because right from the first frame, he's in full command, I would say, of his art. I mean, the feeling of like relentlessness and the feeling of inevitability to me haunts this movie. Is that part of it, because it opens up with Fred McMurray recording the events of the movie. I mean, as the movie opens, half of our characters are already dead, as we'll learn. But the whole thing is a flashback, as Fred McMurray is relating to his boss Keyes the events of what unfolds. So, I mean, part of the film noirishness of this is, of course, the long shadows and the deep dark blacks. I mean, that's what's the hallmark of film noir. But also the inevitability. You know, that these people are involved in something, they kind of know it's going to probably kill them, and yet they do it anyway, because they can't help themselves. And I think that's part of the reason this thing works so well, is that I think we all can relate to that, is that you're sort of doing something you shouldn't be doing, not on the scale, obviously. I think most of us haven't killed anyone, but these two people should not be doing what they're doing, but they just can't help themselves because they are so hot for one another.
Yeah, and it uses this framing device that is I think by now this has become a cliche in television and movies, where you have events taking place in the present, but you keep flashing back up until the point where the story catches up to you. We see that we kind of see it in Citizen Kane, where there is a framing device of, you know, them kind of trying to figure out
who is Charles Foster Kane?
Yeah, what is Rosebud, etc. And then you go up to a movie that I just like. I think I was complaining about this movie on Twitter the other day, Forrest Gump, where he's sitting at a bus station or a bus stop for basically three-fourths of the movie and telling the story to any person who's like – he's basically got a captive audience until the bus shows up. And then like it moves forward when he discovers he had no reason to sit at the bus stop for 3/4 of the movie, whatever. But I mean, this is the type of framing device that goes – I mean, it existed before movies. One of my favorite novels of all time is Frankenstein, and that entire novel's frame story until the point where, like, because, you know, it's narrated on the boat, and then the monster catches up to Frankenstein on the boat, and then we kind of go off from there at the end of the novel. So when it's used effectively, it's really good. And I think Fred McMurray doing the narration as he's recording to this is well structured and well scripted, and doesn't come off as sometimes this comes off as, we didn't know what to do with this footage, so we added this framing device to finish the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I think some films are like that, where they have something that, like, the thing doesn't work, but they add a framing device in because they just like this, because they just need something to tie this film together because the film's a mess. But that's not the case here. It's really, really it's a really tight film that doesn't really meander anywhere, and the script is so, like, well structured.
And that's amazing, too, when you know the backstory. I mean, this is the screenplay is by Billy Wilder and Raymond Chandler, Raymond Chandler, adapting the book by James M. Cain. And apparently Billy Wilder and Raymond Chandler just hated each other. Absolutely loathed one another. And I was doing some research, and some of the stuff seems genuine, that it was like just a creative differences. And then some of it also seemed very petty, where Raymond Chandler didn't like the fact that Billy Wilder wore a hat indoors, because he kept saying, I kept thinking that I was going to get up and leave because he has his hat on all the time. So a lot of it seemed like a lot of petty stuff, but yet, you know, get this film, you're right. It feels very focused. I mean, this movie is only about, it's about an hour and 47 minutes. It moves like lightning. And there's no fat on it. I mean, it just cuts right to the chase, sort of, but what trying to put across, what it's saying, what these characters are getting to. And so you would think that a movie where the two screenwriters just hated each other's guts would not come out as well, and yet it did. And in fact, Raymond Chandler is in this movie. He has a cameo right near the beginning of the movie when Fred McMurray's character walks out of his boss's office, and sitting on a bench reading a paperback is Raymond Chandler. And he looks up, and it's like one of the few, like, I never knew what Raymond Chandler looked like, you know, until I saw this movie. I was like, oh, that's what Raymond Chandler looks like. I didn't realize that. But you're right. The opening narration is terrific. I love the opening scene of when Fred McMurray's character, like you said, Walter Neff, gets in the elevator, and he talks to the elevator operator, and he asks him about how the insurance game is going, and he's like, oh, it's fine. And I love the little bit of dialogue to give to the elevator operator, where he talks about that he can't get insurance because he has like a heart condition. He's like, they won't give me insurance because I have a heart condition. And it's like, wow. So the pre-existing condition bullshit existed even in 1944. I was like, I thought that was more of a modern plague. But no, even back then, insurance companies were still pulling that crap on people. Like, poor elevator operator can't get insurance because he has a heart condition. And then it opens up when he gets out of into the elevator, and we see the office. And it is one of the most amazing sets you've ever seen. It's like the camera looms over the railing, and there's this pit of like 40 – like, I would want to work at that office. It's just so beautiful to look at. You can't believe that, like, they would – the architecture involved in this is just like all they're doing is insurance. But, man, it's so pretty to look at.
It's like – it's almost like just looking at the scene set in the post office – Washington Post Office in All the President's
Men.
Yes,
yes.
Where you can – in that movie, you can tell – you can almost smell the stale coffee and cigarettes.
Yes.
And you can smell – just there you can feel the atmosphere of that room of like – and this is, I think, why journalism students love this movie, because it just feels like you can smell journalism in the air in that movie. And here it is that you get that shot. It's just these rows of desks and everything, and it's – It's that type of office. It's almost boiler room like, but it's not. It's the, you know, and he's got his own office, so that helps establish the fact that Neff is above. He's so good at his job, he's above the pit.
Right.
He's above the bullpen, and he shares an office with somebody else, but he has at least enough pull in the agency. And then you have, you know, Robinson's Keys. You know, who is above him, who is just, you know, he's like, it's like he's trying to be a father figure or something to Neff, because he sees something in Neff, but there's a, but I don't know if, but like Walter Neff's like view of Keys is of admiration at like, and yet like frustration.
That's a desk job. I don't want a desk job. You know?
Yeah.
Because Keys wants to promote Neff, and Neff is not sort of interested. He likes kind of being a hustler. He likes being out on the street, as we see, because the first scene where he goes out hustling insurance is when he meets Barbara Stanwyck's character, Miss Dietrichson. And I mean, I love that that opening scene where he shows up at the house. I love how the maid sizes him up. Where he meets Dietrichson, Miss Dietrichson. Of course, she shows up just in a bath towel, which in 1944 was pretty out there. You know, like, wow, like, okay. You know, like, that's a lot less subtle than what you expect in 1944. And she says, well, have a Mr. Neff wait off in the parlor. And as the maid, you know, carts him off to the room, she mentions, she says, oh, by the way, the Dietrichsons, they keep the liquor all locked up. So it's like, she's met this guy 10 seconds ago, and she's already sizing him up as, like, the shit heel that he will be revealed to be. And so we see that Walter Neff probably wouldn't do really well as Keyes, because Keyes is this straight shooter. And we see really quickly that Neff is pretty sleazy.
Yeah, and like I said, Keyes becomes, and Fred McMurray really expresses this really, really well as the movie goes on, and Keyes does start to get more and more involved in this case with the Dietrich, you know, with Dietrichson and them, you know, and the scheme that they pull, that Keyes becomes more and more of a pain in his ass. And he's like, and you can tell he's always kind of thought as Keyes as a pain in the ass. But at the same time, he's just but at the same time, it's almost like he admires that as well, because Keyes is relentless when he gets an idea in his head about, like, you know, how something will go. And he even mentioned that at the very, very beginning of the movie, where when he calls Neff into his office and there's this guy
yes.
sitting there, and it was basically he had him for insurance fraud, and
he grills the guy like he's a detective. You know, he really he tries to get him. And by the way, I want to mention that actor is a Fortunio Bonanova, who was in Citizen Kane. I always like to mention actors from Citizen Kane. He plays the opera coach. He's the one who's trying to teach Mrs. Kane how to sing, and we realize that it's a hopeless gesture. So there, I love in Citizen Kane, he's like this real officious. You know, he's an opera teacher, and yet here he's like this sort of laborer who's trying to pull one over on the insurance. So that's a pretty diverse filmography, that he could play those two different kinds of characters. And that's a great scene. I love the way that Edward G. Robinson just grills the guy, and he's trying to trip him up and to get him to admit that the whole thing's a scam.
Yeah, and I give Fred McMurray a lot of credit here, because Fred McMurray's most famous role was as he starred in My Three Sons.
Right.
And that was a show that I don't have a lot of experience with, but it did rerun quite a bit when like you and I were kids. And so I can see him in that, and I can see him in this. And he showed the versatility of, granted, it was very many, many years apart from the two roles, but at the same time, like, a great actor who I think was kind of hamstrung by a role that he played was Anthony Perkins, he played Norman Bates so well. And then there's a film version of The Trial, the Franz Kafka novel, right, which Orson Welles directed it.
Yes, he did. Yep.
Because he's in it, and Perkins stars in it, and Perkins does a great job. But like it's very hard to turn off the fact that he's Norman Bates in that film, because he's so ensconced in the role of Norman Bates. And like, you know, Fred McMurray, who was very famous on television for being this person, you go back and look at this earlier movie, I can – maybe it's because I'm so far removed from something like My Three Sons, you know. Maybe if it was like – to me, it's like, you know, if you can see Ted Danson as somebody else other than Sam Malone, which I can. He's good enough of an actor that I can see him, you know, and that's what I see about Fred McMurray. And I see this, and I see how he pulls off the dialogue, because the dialogue in this movie is deliberately written not to sound realistic. It snaps in a way that's like, and I think that's why this movie endures, that it's written so stylistically in terms of, like, nobody talks like this. This so the way he so quickly delivers his lines is like, you know, and calls Barbara Stanwyck baby all the time.
Hey, baby. Like, hey, baby. Yeah. Yeah, they immediately like each other from the very beginning. It is sort of I guess there's something to the fact that you know, Neff is a great insurance agent, and that part of that is that you're good at psychology. You're able at figuring people out, and he's able to figure out that Miss Dietrichson, who is married to Mr. Dietrichson, played by Tom Powers, who is this older man, he's pretty sour. You can't, you know, you imagine that the reason they're married is because he's a sugar daddy to her. Mm-hmm. But he sizes her up instantly. I mean, first of all, again, she shows up just wearing a towel. So, I mean, she's sending signals right from the beginning. But he sizes her up, and he figures out that she might be interested in this whole plot, which is to bump off her husband and make it seem like it was an accident, and then just before she would book this insurance policy out on him, and it would end up becoming double indemnity, so it would be like a double payoff. And there's all these great scenes where he is just flirting with what you really can't say out loud, which is, let's kill him. Let's just do it and kill him. You can't say that out loud, so they have to kind of dance around it. And of course, this film features one of the great, you know, like film noir dialogue scenes back and forth, which is the whole bit about where he starts putting the moves on her. And she says, "There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff." And he's like, "How fast was I going, officer?" And she's like, "You're going 95. And then they're going back and forth. And you know, it's the kind of thing where nowadays, of course, if that dialogue was in a movie, they would just be using the F word all the time because there's no restraints on movies now. But in 1944, they couldn't say what they were trying to get at, so they have to dance around it. And that was something Billy Wilder was really good at, was sort of dancing around what could not be said in, you know, pre-R-rated movies. And so it's like these two really want to get on each other really hot and heavy, but they can't say that, so they have to kind of dance around it. And there's something about, you mentioned Fred McMurray's, you know, the My Three Sons. This was a guy that outside of this movie did mostly kind of genial comedies. He was in the Egg and I with, you know, and he did all those Disney movies. He was like Flubber and all these other Absent-Minded Professor. And yet there was something about Billy Wilder that seemed to see the real seedy side of Fred McMurray, because he worked with Fred McMurray later on in The Apartment, where Fred McMurray is a guy that uses Jack Lemmon's apartment for his trysts. And so while the rest of the world saw Fred McMurray as this kind of friendly dad-like figure, every time he was in a Billy Wilder movie, he's like an asshole. You know, he's like a jerk. And so there was something that Wilder saw in him that was able to tap that in Fred McMurray, because Fred McMurray is great in this. He's just so sleazy from the beginning. He just – the way he always giving everybody kind of this side eye, like he's just kind of – and with the whole baby, hey, baby, you know. Yeah. And he is just so – creepy and oozes that thing, and there's something, again, Wilder just clearly saw it in Fred McMurray, and all props to Fred McMurray for indulging him. You know, I could see an actor maybe not wanting to reveal that side of him, but he was obviously comfortable working with Wilder and presenting that ugly side to his character.
Yeah, and he and Stanwyck both, they come at, especially that scene, they come at the scene straight. Whereas in a more, if you were shooting this today, even if you didn't change the dialogue, you would have had an actor and actress who would have like leaned into the double entendre of it all, where it almost like where they would be winking at the camera, and I don't think that would have worked. So like when they do that back and forth, it's just it's very very quick, and there's no like. The tone is just straight, and that's I think what makes it work. And then he's sleazy, and they're both assholes, but they don't oversell this, and I think that's another thing that works about it so well. I think that was with setting shooting this today, you would get too many people who would ham this up. And who would feel that they have to lean too far into the performance, whereas like you don't need to do that. You just let the script speak for itself, and you deliver lines, and you let the events play out as they are, and the audience can see how terrible you are, you know. And there's other things that you can't show, like the idea that you know, she obviously has the idea to kill the husband. And then he's the one who comes up with the idea to do it on a moving train, because that's where the double indemnity clause kicks in. It's this, and he does define it where it's, you know, you have an accident policy, meaning that there is a payout in case of an accidental death. So like a car accident. But if it happens in a place where this is not expected, like on a moving train, you get double the pay. So that's where they come up with this plot to kill him and then fake that he fell off the train, and they dump the body on the tracks, and they
Neff will board the train pretending to be the husband, and then they'll dump the body, and then when they find the body, they'll be like, oh, he fell off the train and that's how he died. Oh, okay. Yeah.
And you've got this great scene. Again, the fact that they had to do this, I'm assuming this is, I don't remember when the Hays Code came out. Was this within the Hays Code?
This is after the Hays Code kicked in. Yeah.
All right. So we're under the code, and you know, he strangles Diedrichson in the car, and we never see him do it because it's one of my favorite scenes in the entire film, because before he gets on the train, they pull the car. You know, she's driving him. He's hiding in the back. The husband gets into the passenger seat, And when they stop off, he's like, hey, where are we going? This isn't the way to the railroad station. She stops. I think she like honks the horn three times and McMurray comes out from the back and he just – he strangles the guy. But the entire scene of him strangling the guy, it's just focused on Barbara Stanwyck's face.
Yep.
And it's shot where like, you know, there's darkness and there's a little bit of light coming over her eyes. And since this is black and white, it's very smoky. It's such a brilliantly shot scene. And I don't know if that was because of the Hays Code or it's just because of, you know, or if that while it was while they're being constrained by the code and having to come up with a creative way to do it or not. But it just it makes the murder even more effective than if you had done what we, you know, what we've seen in horror movies a million times of like, you know, strangling and blood and gore and like, you know, all the things to make it quote realistic. And I think I just it's one of my favorite parts of the movie just because of the way it's shot.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, I've never read anything about whether, you know, Wilder would have done it differently had he been able to. But yeah, it works perfectly in that we are holding on her as we hear, you know. And I love how much they don't shy away from how much of an asshole Mr. Dietrichson is. He's so he's so sour. He's so mean spirited. And like when she's driving, you know, when they're driving in the car, and you know, he of course we know what's going to happen. He doesn't know, and he's like, why are you honking the horn? Like, he's an asshole up to the very end. It's like, on some level, we kind of are on their side. You're like, yeah, just kill this guy. He's terrible. Yeah. He's such a rotten person. And we, I mean, we get the idea that the reason these two, they hatch this plot, and it never occurs to either one of them not to do it, is because I get to read that, like, neither one of them has any friends. Like, Walter Neff, he lives in this apartment, and he talks to the guy that runs the maintenance guy in the garage.
Yeah.
But we don't get the sense that Neff has any real friends, and certainly Phyllis Dietrichson is kind of like the caged bird, so she doesn't really have any friends. There's a stepdaughter, and there's a whole subplot about her, played by Jean Heather, but they're not friends, because she's almost the same age, because again, Phyllis is sort of the trophy wife. So like, they don't have any friends to maybe, you know, mention, hey, you know, maybe we could do, some friend might say, what are you, crazy? Don't do that. Don't hook up with this crazy woman. She's trouble. But because the minute they see each other, they recognize in each other this sort of, you know, callousness and this ability to, you know, end somebody's life for a payout, it seems perfectly reasonable that they're going to go ahead with this plan. And I love that. Again, it's that inevitability of like, oh God, don't do this, but you know they're going to anyway. And I mean, I like one of the things I like about Billy Wilder, and I think what gives his movies verisimilitude, is that like, and they're unique, is that his movies mentioned pop culture. A couple episodes ago, I did an episode with Tim Wallace talking about 1-2-3, and in that movie, that's Billy Wilder, 1961, there's a bunch of references to other movies. And in this movie, like, Fred McMurray mentions The Philadelphia Story, you know, which was a movie just a couple of years earlier. Now it's an anachronistic mention because this movie takes place in 1938, and that was before the play or the movie, but who cares? It doesn't matter. But I mean, I love that. I mean, you get the sense these are real people. They go to movies. Like, just because Walter Neff is a murderer doesn't mean he doesn't go to a movie once in a while.
Yeah.
So, you know, I like, and that's early on, I like all that stuff. And so, yeah, they hatch this plot where they're going to throw the body off the train. And of course, it all goes wrong. Like, it doesn't even, they're caught pretty quickly. And this is apparently, from the novel that James Cain wrote, is based on a real story from the 1920s about a woman that tried to kill her husband, and they were caught almost immediately. Like, they didn't fool anybody.
Yeah, I was Ruth Snyder is the name of the woman, because if you go on the Wikipedia page, they actually have a little bit of background on it. And let's see, she persuaded her husband to purchase insurance. I'm cribbing off Wikipedia here. And the couple, her and somebody else killed her husband. And they said detectives at the scene noticed that they faked it as a burglary. And they said that the burglar left little evidence of breaking into the house. Moreover, the behavior of Mrs. Snyder was inconsistent with her story of a terrorized wife witnessing her husband being killed. And the police then found the property that she said had been stolen because it was still in the house, but she'd hidden it in the way. And
real criminal masterminds.
Oh, yeah. It was just basically like these two idiots had committed like what they thought would be the perfect crime. Here, at least, there's the crime that they have committed is – it's tighter than that. You know, like, Neff goes out of his way to know what he has to do in order to get away with this murder, because he's trying to think like Keyes, and he's trying to – he's witnessed Keyes uncover these things enough, because once the little man – and I love how it's like Keyes gets like heartburn, and it's his conscience, or it's his like instincts. It's a little man inside me, and I love that like repeated bit about the little man. But like Neff's watched this enough that he's trying to stay one step ahead of his adversary, like where he perceives a cat and mouse game is going to happen, and it sort of starts, but it ends before it can really get going, because he's just he is double crossed by Phyllis, and I don't know if he gets a conscience because he starts spending a lot of time with the daughter Lola, and he feels bad for her or what. But
right, because she has this rotten boyfriend who's kind of like this rough trade guy, and he gets a little bit involved, and he has a sort of slight paternalistic attitude towards her, because you know clearly she was raised in not a very loving atmosphere.
Yeah, and what's his name is.
The boyfriend?
Nino Sarchetti.
Nino Sarchetti, yeah.
Nino Sarchetti. Like,
the minute you see him, he's just argumentative with everybody right at the beginning.
Yeah, and like this is back in the day where like if you wanted some guy to kind of like sound like a real sleazy lowlife, you gave him like an incredibly Italian name or something.
We all know what that means, right? Wink.
Yeah. So, but yeah, he is. And please, Lola again. I can't remember her name.
Jean Heather.
Yeah, I looked at her filmography, and she—I hadn't seen her in anything else, but she's gorgeous.
Oh yeah, and, you can see why. Right, you can see why the Nino would sort of look at her as like, you know, because he's like a kid from the streets,
yeah,
probably like a two-bit hustler, and you can see he's kind of nabbed like a rich girl, you know. I mean, and she's so you can see why, and she's probably not the again she doesn't have the greatest probably relationship with her father because he's such a jerk. And so she's looking for a father figure, and he's this kind of tough guy. And you can see that this relationship is going to go horrible. Horribly. She just doesn't know it.
Yeah. And Lola is kind of the key for Neff for figuring out that Phyllis really is just using him to get this money, because she relates the story of her own mother's death, and that Lola that Phyllis was the nurse.
Right.
And she's like, well, she left the windows open and she caught it. So basically it's a way to imply that she slowly killed the mother in order to move in on the husband.
Right.
Which is a plot that would be repeated a number of times over. I'm pretty sure this is at least one Law and Order episode somewhere. And Mike Bailey's like, yeah, it probably is. But that kind of clues him in into like what he's gotten himself into. And then, but it eventually, like, he can't get out of it. You know, it's not like he tries to turn her into the police or anything else. It's just, you know, she ends up killing him, or she ends up shooting him, and he ends up killing her before, you know, any of that can happen.
Yeah, he even says at one point, it's you and I all the way. You know, he knows that we have to see this to the end. I mean, I've talked about that they have this sort of coded dialogue back and forth. And it continues to go on, like when she invites him back to get the papers signed for the insurance forms, and then she pretends, "Oh, I forgot that my husband's not here. I thought I invited you here, to sign. I forgot he's not even here." And then she wants to get him a drink, and she goes, "Oh, I forgot today's the maid's day off." And you're like, she knows that it's not like you know, and he knows that she knows that he knows that she's lying. Like they have this, you know, back and forth kind of thing where it's like, we're all just playing pretend, but yet he can't stay away from her. I mean, she has this anklet that he goes on and on about, and I never found Barbara Stanwyck to be particularly alluring necessarily, even in kind of a 40s style. Like, it just not. And she was given this blonde wig that apparently even Billy Wilder later on regretted, but they had shot too much footage. They couldn't do anything with it. Apparently one of the studio heads said, she looks like George Washington or something. So
yeah, and from what I remember from the textbook that we had in that film class that I was talking about at the beginning of the show, they were talking about how it was meant to portray like a Marlene Dietrich sort of look, which I can see. But you're right. She's not she was a model. Stanwyck was a model at one point or another, but she wasn't like Ingrid Bergman, who around this time was, you know, in Casablanca. And Ingrid Bergman is like unbelievably just naturally attractive, or like later on Grace Kelly.
Oh, wow.
You know,
sure.
She's not that Barbara Stanwyck is not like, if you hold those two up as sort of like a pinnacle of like beauty in that older Hollywood sort of way, Stanwyck's not there, but she's not unattractive. And she fits, like, her look almost fits that character.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, she seems like she's someone, she knows how to relate to men, obviously, again, because she, mm-hmm. she wormed her way into the Dietrichsons' home, and then she gets this guy, she meets Walter Neff, and within, you know, like what, like two scenes, he's ready to commit murder for her, you know, like, mm-hmm. so she's very manipulative, but you don't necessarily figure that way. I love the scene, there's a great cheat in this movie where she's hiding. They go over to Neff's apartment, and she has to hide, and she hides behind a door that opens up, and you find out that you see that the door to his apartment opens up into the hallway, which doors do not do. Your door to your apartment does not open out into the hall. It opens inside.
And it's an error noted on the IMDb page, yep. that like it's against the code, but you kind of let it go because that scene is so well composed, yes. that there's a little bit of suspense there because like you don't necessarily want these two to get away with this, but at the same time in that scene, like you want Keys to leave. Because Keys is dead, he keeps coming back, and he's talking about the little man and all that, and like she's hiding behind the door, and he's opening it just a little more slightly so that she knows that he has to, or like no, she opens it a little bit while he's holding on to the knob so that he knows that she's behind the door, and like you're kind of hoping that this works and that Keys leaves, and like, you know, because after a while you are like, all right, could you leave now? Like, where's the elevator coming? But yeah, I love that scene, even though it's totally incorrect in terms of its, the way the door swings.
The first time I saw it, I was like, wait, what? Like the doors don't open like that. But again, it doesn't bother me.
You let it go. Fine. Yeah.
Yeah. It works out just fine. And he said, there is something about the way Edward G. Robinson plays Barton Keys that he is kind of, he's definitely in love with himself. Like, he's definitely mm-hmm. in love with his own ingenuity and his own. And so, yeah, you are. And again, you're never on Neff or Dietrichson's side, no. because they have committed a murder, but they did kill somebody really terrible. And so you're just kind of like, well, all right, I don't want to see them get away with it. But at the same time, you have some sympathy for them because it's these two kind of dum-dums that get caught up in something so far.
Yeah.
I mean, there's these famous scenes, two different scenes where they have to communicate back and forth in like a grocery store, mm-hmm. and they're trying to relay this. They're trying to talk about this murder they're committing, and they're trying to do it like where they pretend that nobody, they don't know each other. So they both have to pretend that they're like staring at the beans or the or the carrots. And you have a woman who's like, hello, sir, can you hand me that can of corn? I don't know why they put it up so high. And you're just like, will you leave them alone? Like, they're trying to figure this out, lady. It's like, and this whole movie is full of that kind of like that frustrated tension where you're, you know, and the scene of you got Walter Neff on the train, and there's a guy that starts talking to him, and the guy just won't leave. Like, he won't leave Walter Neff alone, even though Neff's trying to pull this plan, and you're getting so frustrated because you're like, this guy is just, you know, he doesn't know what he's doing, but he's getting involved in Neff's plot, and Neff's I just have to just do this thing where I throw the body over the train. You leave me alone for 2 seconds.
Well, and he's also like, the other thing about that is that like we've all run into that guy in public who you just run into, and he just talks to you and talks to you and talks to you, and you're just like, uh-huh, and it goes beyond like your personal time limit of pleasant conversation and small talk in public with a stranger.
Yeah.
And you're in a situation where you're kind of trapped into the conversation, you know, like you're in a waiting room for a doctor's office or something. I had that happen to me. I was waiting on my car. I was like at Merchant Tire when this guy was going on and on, and about like, because I was reading that Stephen King novel, 11/22/63, and he just started talking to me about the JFK conspiracy.
Oh,
and I was just, I'm like nodding and nodding, and I'm listening. But like, we've met that guy. We've met that, like, and this guy's like, you know, I'm from Medford, Oregon, and like, you know, I'm a Medford man. And you're just like, what the, like, okay, you're a Medford man, and you're just like, could you leave? And he finally says, you know, I left my cigar case back, and he's like, oh, I'll get it for you, like, you know, taking advantage of the kindness of the stranger, or the fact that this guy is like really gregarious, and he would be willing to do you a favor because you're on crutches, because Diedrichson had injured himself on the job, and that's the thing that that tips off Keys later, in that they trick Mr. Diedrichson into signing this policy, and he's so like, you're right, he's such an asshole, he's so like flustered, ah, oh, why I gotta sign all this paperwork, duplicate, triplicate,
yeah, rah, yeah. Rah, he's about signing his name twice, like, yeah, big deal, dude.
Because he's basically renewing like an auto insurance policy or something to that extent, I think it is. And so what Neff does is he basically gives him like two policies, and he's so like annoyed that he has to sign the thing, he never reads what he signs.
Right.
All right, fine. We've all not read the terms and conditions in the iTunes agreement.
Right.
Oh, great.
Right.
And there are ways to do this in the modern day where you wouldn't have insurance agents coming over, and you might. But at the same time, if he knew he had the accident policy, and he was kind of a cheap bastard too, based on what she told Neff, like, you know, when I come home with two hats, he complains about why do I have to buy two or three hats. He even does it in front of Neff. He complains about like how much money she spends of his. That Keys is like, why didn't he call in a claim? Because he's had an accident on the job. That's, in the very least, it's workers' compensation, right? And that's what sets Keys off on this path that like he was not this was not an accident, and the owner of the insurance company I think thinks it's suicide at first, and even Keys is like no, that doesn't make sense, and so that's how the plot unravels, because they're too impatient to wait until, you know, later on,
right,
to stage it after he had the thing, you know. And if it was because if you think about it, if they had waited a few months and they had done it then after the leg had healed, and Keys was like, why didn't he activate the clause? Neff could have said something to the extent of kind of ignorance on the part of the policyholder. Oh, I forgot I had the clause now. Or something like really easy to kind of like write off, no pun intended,
right,
in terms of the insurance policy. But like they get so impatient to do it, and she so wants that money that – That's how they get nailed.
Right. And their relationship is like a comet, you know, like it won't sustain itself. These two, if they had even gotten away with this plot, they're not going to live out the rest of their lives together in retirement. No. They're hot for each other. They want to bone each other really bad. And they're, you know, it's the kind of thing where they would probably, if they had pulled it off, they would, you know, maybe take the money, fly off get somewhere, go down to Mexico, go somewhere where there's no, you know, where they would not be extradited. But then they would probably end up either breaking up or killing each other anyway, because that's just their personality. I mean, and that, you're right, that's why they can't wait. If they were in a real relationship, you would just wait. You would say, well, I really want to be with this person for the rest of my life, so we're going to do something horrible, but let's do it right. But no, everything's – you got to do it in a hurry. We've got to do it right now, because they both recognize they're just completely giving into their totally libidinous, you know, passions, and that's why it goes on. And originally, this movie ends with a scene of Neff going to the gas chamber. And
oh, really?
Apparently Wilder cut that bit, and apparently they even shot it and showed it, actually, apparently to a preview audience, but then they cut it and reshot the ending where it ends with Keys confronting Neff and being with him, because he felt like that was more – it needed to stay more about these three characters. And it was funny. I was reading about that when Wilder offered this movie to Edward G. Robinson, he didn't want to do it because it was the third – it wasn't the lead. It was the third, you know, like the side guy. And,
yeah,
and at that point, he was still a main star, but he had gotten a little older by that point. I mean, of course, he was in silent films, and he was in all these great gangster movies of the 30s, but he recognized that he was getting older, and he was transitioning to these more film noir side sort of performances, and so we took it. And apparently his salary was the same as Stanwyck's and McMurray, and that, I'm sure that helped a bit. And you know, this really did kick off like a whole other part of Robinson's career. After this, he went and did Fritz Lang's Woman in the Window, which is a great film noir. He did Orson Welles' The Stranger, where he plays kind of a similar character, a guy who's on the side of the right hunting down the main character who has committed a murder. In this case, it's Orson Welles is playing an ex-Nazi. So, I mean, this was really the transition for Robinson. And he said he really does kind of carry off the movie because, like I said, our main two characters are such terrible people that even though Robinson is kind of, you know, humorless in some ways, you know, he's our hero ostensibly. We have nobody else really to root for.
Yeah, but you're less rooting for somebody, and you're more like intrigued in how this is going to play out by
right,
the end.
Yes.
Like he is the hero in that he's the one good guy in the entire story, but he's never held up as like a pinnacle of morality. He's right. Just held up as the guy who's smarter than these two, you know, and they're not that bumbling of idiots, but they are idiots, but you know, they're not like, slapstick comedy type of,
no,
you know,
no.
Bungle the job type of things, the type of people. And, but you want to see how you're intrigued and invested enough to see how this plays out. And it's less of a, I want him to get them because, you know, the good guy has to win. And it's like, I want to see if he catches them.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, he's so good at his job. Let's see if he, so this is a challenge for him. And that's when, like, when he does come to the apartment and he does talk about how this keeps coming back to bother him and he's got heartburn. In fact, I think he asked him for like a bicarb or something. You're like, in the back of your mind, you're like, all right, the game's on. Let's see if they get away with it. And so that's where you keep your invested as a viewer. But yeah, Robinson is, he's just, yeah, he's just so good. I mean, I think this is one of the only movies I've ever really seen him in.
Oh, he's terrific. He's just such a bundle of energy. He always was in all of his movies. He's got this tough guy. I mean, you know, he's by a certain generation, he's kind of known in a comical way because he's in the Ten Commandments.
Oh, that's
and
right.
He plays the same kind of, hey, where's your Moses now? And he doesn't fit in that movie at all. And so to a certain generation, he represented kind of this hammy acting. And that isn't really fair. He was just miscast in that movie.
Yeah. So I haven't seen the Ten Commandments in like 20 years. So that's why I don't remember. But it's, you know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of like Ernest Borgnine.
Yeah.
Where there's a wonderful TV adaptation of All Quiet on the Western Front starring Richard Thomas as Paul Ballmer. And it works really well. But Ernest Borgnine is Kaczynski. And he's good in the movie, but he's still Ernest Borgnine, you know.
Right. So. Yeah. It's Edward G. Robinson was good at a particular kind of type of role. And it doesn't mean, you know, he wasn't a great actor. It was just, you just shouldn't be in Bible epics. That's all. they offered this part of Walter Neff to a lot of people, Alan Ladd, George Raft, Brian Donlevy, James Cagney, Spencer Tracy, Gregory Peck, and Frederick March. I can't picture, any of those. Well, George Raft, I could. Gregory Peck seems much too straightforward and honest to play such a murderous person. Frederick March, he would have been almost as old as Mr. Dietrichson, so that wouldn't have made a whole lot of sense. Spencer Tracy, I can't see. James Cagney, maybe. I don't know. Alan Ladd, definitely. So, but they went with the right person.
Cagney had such a style, you know?
Him, like, I could picture him as the Edward G. Robinson part.
Cagney reminds me of like Jackie Gleason and like those actors who were like so embodied of a certain style and mannerisms and things that it wouldn't get away with it. And Tracy was just – Tracy's like the Paul Newman of his day. It's like, you know –
He would have been too old too.
He would have been too old. And Peck, yeah, you're right. Peck's too upstanding of a – it wouldn't work. Maybe like a Robert Mitchum or somebody like that, you know.
Oh, Robert Mitchum, sure.
Yeah, like you need a certain amount of just a little bit of darkness about the person playing him.
Yeah.
Stanwyck is very, very well cast as well. Incidentally, she was nominated for this for Best Actress.
Yeah, the movie was nominated for 7 Oscars, didn't win a single one.
Yeah, it lost Best Motion Picture to Going My Way, Best Director, same one, but she lost to Ingrid Bergman for Gaslight.
Ah.
Which is another I haven't seen all of that movie, but that is another one of this it's film noir-ish genre. Mm-hmm. And then it lost Best Screenplay for Going My Way. And then Cinematography, music, score, and then sound recording in Lost as well.
Yeah. Stanwyck was certainly very diverse. I could handle a lot of different things. Her next film after this was Christmas in Connecticut, which is a favorite around here, and it's about as far away from this movie as possible. It's a light, frothy Christmas comedy, and she's great in it. She's very funny, and she could do Screwball. She was in a Preston Sturges movie, so she went on to one of, like, you know, the great film careers. And Billy Wilder, I mentioned at the top of the show that this was really the first movie that put him on the map, and he did a bunch of great movies in the 40s. But Billy Wilder, I want to list, because this is the first movie of his, well, not the first, we did 1, 2, 3, but this is his earliest film that we've covered here on the show. I want to talk about the movies he did. This was his 1950s output. This is what he did from 1950 through 1959 in a row: Sunset Boulevard, Ace in the Hole, Stalag 17, Sabrina, The 7-Year Itch, The Spirit of St. Louis, Love in the Afternoon, Witness for the Prosecution, and Some Like It Hot. I mean, that is a run unparalleled in probably all of film.
And then add The Apartment in 1960.
And then in 1968, he starts a new decade with The Apartment. I mean, good Lord, Eisenhower didn't have a 50s that good. I mean, that is unreal how many classics there are all in a row. That is beyond anything hardly anybody's ever managed to achieve. It's just – he just – again, this is a great movie, and he went and did The Lost Weekend right after this, which won a bunch of Oscars. But that – he went on to just one of the great film directorial careers of all time.
When he's cranking them out at like almost like a film a year, which is not something you get nowadays either. I mean, I'm trying to think of people who have that deep of a bench in terms. Spielberg, yeah, and even Spielberg in toward the end of the 80s had his like kind of a lull here and there. Nothing against The Color Purple or Empire of the Sun, but you know, when you're coming off Raiders and you're going E.T. and you're going into, you know, that sort of stuff, and then, you know, he has had his kind of lull periods as well,
right? Like Always or Hook, just stuff that was not the mega successes. And then of course he would come out with Jurassic Park and Schindler's List back to back. So I mean, he kind of wound himself down and then cranked back up. But yeah, Billy Wilder, really just really one of the most amazing people ever to do it, and in all these different genres. I mean, not on top of all those movies being great, it's a romantic comedy, it's a war film, it's a film noir, it's a, you know, I mean, he could handle all sorts of different things. It's just unreal.
Yeah, and like, you think of directors who do get really famous, and then they get that sort of, where they take a long time between their next projects. Kind of like bands who will put out their first 3 or 4 albums within the first, like, 6 or 7 years of the career, and then the next album's, like, 4 years later, and it's whatever. And you think of, like, kind of these auteur directors directors who are really well-known. Like, you know, Oliver Stone had his you know, I'm hot and cold on Oliver Stone's films, but he had, a really, really huge output in the 80s. But then as he got into the 90s, it was kind of like, you know, some stuff was few and far between, or like, you know, sometimes you don't realize like an Oliver Stone movie has come out, and then like Stanley Kubrick,
right?
It got more, longer and longer and longer for a Kubrick film to come out. Yep. And it was, so what Wilder did, like, and then his last film was in
1981.
And now he didn't have, like, you know, you get to the, let's see, Kiss Me Stupid in 64, The Fortune Cookie in 66. And then he had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 movies after that. So the 70s, he only made like 4 movies.
Right. And he lived all the way till 2002. So, I mean, he consciously retired, even though he was still around and did interviews. And he famously was friends with Cameron Crowe. And Cameron Crowe and Tom Cruise begged him to play the part of Tom Cruise's mentor in Jerry Maguire, all those flashbacks. And he refused. He just said, I refuse to do it. And apparently, he seemed sort of enjoyed teasing Cameron Crowe, because he said something like, you know, he's like, oh, this part is I can't handle it. I'm no actor. I can't handle this part. And then Cameron Crowe thought he had him by saying, well, it's a tiny part. You don't need to be a great actor. Well, it's too tiny a part for me then. You know, so you got him coming and going. I mean, Wilder was not at times the nicest guy in the world. There's a story about how you mentioned that this film was beat out by Going My Way for Best Picture. Mm-hmm. And apparently during the Oscars, Billy Wilder literally tripped Going My Way's director, Leo McCarey, as he was walking down the aisle to get his Oscar.
Such literally a dick move. Out through,
like, what an asshole. I mean, come on, Billy. What are you doing? I mean, and then, of course, he won the very next year for The Lost Weekend. So, you know, I mean, it wasn't he had to get away for long. But, you know, I mean, hey, you know, the guy made great movies. What can I say?
That's the type of move some, like, asshole would do in high school.
Yeah.
To, like, you know, the kid accepting an award and he trips, like, the bully trips the kid and everybody laughs at the kid going up to the thing. I'm like...
Yeah. He famously said about the Hollywood 10, those 10 writers that were blacklisted.
Yeah.
Well, only 9 of them weren't any good anyway. So it wasn't always the nicest guy in the world. But before we wrap up here, there is one little data point that I want to mention, which to me is related to this movie. One of the other actors we have not mentioned, Porter Hall, plays Mr. Jackson in this movie. Fred McMurray, Porter Hall, and Gene Heather all reunited for another movie a couple years later. It was in a movie called Murder, He Says, which is, in fact, not a film noir. It's a comedy. And this is I've never heard of this movie, I've never seen it, but this is the plot description on IMDb. A pollster stumbles on a family of murderous hillbillies and joins in their search for hidden treasure. I have to see this movie now. Just that description. That's like the most insane movie I've ever. It's like The Hills Have Eyes, but it's got Fred McMurray in it, and they search for hidden treasures. It's got that. I have to see that movie. That just sounds really, like a great
movie. It's a really dark Beverly Hillbillies episode.
Oh, Jethro! Oh, yeah, it sounds fantastic. So, Double Indemnity. It's just one of the great movies of all time. It makes total sense that would be in, like, your film class early on, because it is just one of those movies that you want to teach somebody about great old movies. That's one you show them. It holds up really well. I saw it on the big screen last year. They did it for part of the Turner Classic Movies big screen classic series. I took my nephew, and we just had a blast. It's just so much fun to watch.
Yeah, I get jealous when you post about that, because they don't have that. There's a couple of theaters down here that do that, but they don't do it on a regular basis. And we have an Alamo Draft House, but again, going to the movies when you do is sometimes a pain in the ass, right? Especially when you have a 10-year-old. But I did see some like it hot at the Paramount Theater down here in downtown Charlottesville a number of years ago, and it was great to see on the big screen. And the last classic movie I saw was Close Encounters, which I took my 10-year-old to. So that was really cool. So yeah, I'm trying to track down those old movies and stuff when I can, because although this works really well on a television too.
Yeah. It's not widescreen. It's shiny.
It has that feel of, I think I actually watched it on my Kindle, so because it was streaming. It's not available for free streaming anywhere that I actually got. I don't have a subscription of Filmstruck yet, because I was trying to cut down on the streaming services I pay for but don't use.
They multiply, don't they?
Oh, God. It's like a gym membership. That's why I dropped Hulu. So I was like, I'm not even using this. And I'm still using Netflix, but even Netflix's film selection has become so bad.
Yeah,
and,
it has.
I think somebody compared it to like a Blockbuster on a Friday night when the only thing left over was like Die Hard 4. I saw that on Twitter once. I was like, that's freaking brilliant. But I keep forgetting. I keep having to remind myself that if you have to pay for a rental on Amazon Prime, you're essentially paying like video store prices from like 10 or 20 years ago. Because I think it was like $2.99 or $3.99, which is what I would have paid at Blockbuster back in the 90s. So I'm like, okay. So I rented it and I watched it on my Kindle. But this still holds up as like, it almost feels like something you would have stumbled upon late at night when your insomnia is kicking in and you're trying to see if there's something on television. It's sort of like, you know, million-dollar movie classic thing, and that's one of the charms of it. But yeah, it's so well composed. I totally see why they had us do this for one of the genres in one of the movies in my film class back in college.
Yeah, it is one of the great classics. So, well, awesome. Well, Tom, thank you so much for coming on, man. I'm sorry it took so long. We're 141 episodes into the show to finally have you on, but we finally did it. So where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me over I have 3 podcasts over on the Two True Freaks Network, which is the twotruefreaks.com. My main one is Pop Culture Affidavit. is the podcast that covers everything random in the world of popular culture. You can find that also at popcultureaffidavit.com. I have In Country, which is taking an issue by issue look at the Marvel Comics series, The Nam. I also take a look at some Vietnam War movies, books, etc. And when we're recording this, I'm right at the beginning of a four-part backup in that series about the 80s television show China Beach, which fans of your MASH cast, I hope, will just kind of take a look at those four episodes, because that show is just
great show, great show,
brilliant, brilliant show. And then the third podcast I have, I do with Stella, and it's called Required Reading with Tom and Stella. We're both teachers. We take a look at one book each episode and just kind of dig into it and see whether or not it's worth teaching and what we think about it. And you can also find that at requiredreadingwithtomandstella.com. And you can follow me over on Twitter at PopAff. That's PopAff.
All right, very cool. And of course, you want to find back episodes of our show, go to the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, and there you can leave comments about this episode. And we're always talking movies over on Twitter at Film and Water Pod. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And until the next episode, that's a wrap.
You're a smart insurance man, aren't you, Mr. Neff?
Well, I've been at it 11 years.
Doing pretty well?
Well, it's a living.
You handle just automobile insurance or all kinds?
All kinds. Fire, earthquake, theft, public liability, group insurance, industrial stuff, and so on right down the line.
Accident insurance?
Accident insurance? Sure, Mr. Dietrichson. Would you tell me what's engraved on that anklet?
Just my name.
As, for instance?
Phyllis.
Phyllis, huh? I think I like that.
But you're not sure.
I'd have to drive it around the block a couple of times.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head on your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it. 8:30 tomorrow evening, ma'am.
That's what I suggested.
Will you be here, too?
I guess so. I usually am.
Same chair, same perfume, same anklet.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.